April 19th, 1995, Timothy McVeigh drove into downtown Oklahoma City in a rented Ryder truck containing a deadly fertilizer bomb that he had made with his Army buddy, Terry Nichols. He abandoned the truck in a parking lot, and shortly after 9 o'clock, the bomb obliterated one-third of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, killing 168 people, including 19 infants and toddlers. McVeigh claimed he'd worked only with Nichols, and the government maintained his assertions. But McVeigh's account was just one version of events, and much of it was wrong, according to our next guest. Andrew Gumbel is the co-author of the new book, Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. He's written the book along with Roger Charles, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andrew Gumbel to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
And thank you.
What brought you, the two of you, to this subject?
I think both of us had the idea from early on that the version that we'd heard, both from the government and from McVeigh himself in his booklex interview with two journalists from the Buffalo News, seemed to not quite add up. And that has now been confirmed because years later we managed to get a hold of the full archive of government documents in the case as handed over to the defense teams at trial, both of the federal trials and Terry Nichols' state trial in Oklahoma that followed on. And it was further confirmed when I used those documents as an excuse to approach everyone involved in the case, investigators, managers for the FBI and the ATF, people from the Justice Department, prosecutors, defense lawyers, and so on, and found that a lot of them were not only willing to talk on the record very frankly, but were also immensely frustrated, if not actually angry, at the way things turned out 15, 17 years ago, and that a big part of the picture was missed by the investigation and at trial.
How was it missed? It seems as though it became that they got lucky, they found a name, and then they just went with it.
That, I think, is right. I mean, you know, taking the long view of American history, whenever you look at these big national tragedies, whether, you know, you stretch all the way back to the Lincoln assassination or the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, I think there's a desire to find someone to blame, to be able to say the story now fits, we can understand why this awful thing happened, and we can move on. It's a tempting thing to do, but I don't think it serves the country terribly well to view its history in that way. And in particular, when you're looking at attacks on innocent people, I think a lot of hard questions need to be asked. Are the law enforcement agencies of these countries anticipating risks effectively? And when awful things like this happen, do they get to the bottom of it? And there's no simple answer to the question of why a chunk of the story was missed. But essentially, you know, there were several phases of it. One phase is that the FBI and the ATF both were caught napping when they should have been looking very hard at the risk, at the threat from the radical far right in the early to mid-90s. Some of their best agents were screaming from the rooftops, just as some of their best agents were screaming in the run-up to 9/11 and were ignored. There was a certain amount of embarrassment at what they had failed to do, information they'd failed to pool and share and act on, a failure of nerve, especially in the wake of disasters that had unfolded at Ruby Ridge in Idaho and at Waco, most famously in 1993. And then after the investigation, I think there was a tremendous imperative from the prosecutors primarily to keep things simple, to keep the focus on McVeigh and Nichols, make sure that the convictions were secured against them, ideally get the death penalty against both of them. And in the case of McVeigh, they were successful. In the case of Nichols, he had terrific lawyers, and the government was not successful in pressing capital charges. And in fact, most of the main murder charges against him were dismissed by the jury. And the reason for that is that the lawyers managed to pinpoint many ways in which the FBI had fallen down on the job, had presented things in ways that didn't quite hold up to scrutiny. And in particular, the government had held back on the information it had and that we as authors now have in our possession, pointing to the involvement of others.
I do want to talk about that involvement and talk about what was missed in this investigation. But as a baseline, give us a sense of what they got right in the story. Our narrative of what we know, what did they get right?
What they got right is that Timothy McVeigh drove the Ryder truck into Oklahoma City. They got right the fact that he was front and center of the plot. I think if you ask most FBI investigators on the case, they will tell you that the killing of the children in the daycare center was absolutely deliberate, and my research has borne that out. I found out that McVeigh actually visited the daycare center 4 months before the bombing. He pretended to be an Army recruiter moving into town from Wichita. He didn't have a name tag. He didn't give his name. He wouldn't give his children's name. And all he wanted to ask about was security arrangements at the daycare. And the director at the time, Danielle Wise, and her husband-to-be, who was in fact the head of Federal Protective Service at the building, who walked in on them, they both thought that he was absolutely alarming. And then after the bombing, they saw his name saw his face on the television. They knew absolutely that he'd been there. He knew the daycare was there, and he had made it a deliberate target. So all of that they got right. What they did not get right, or at least overlooked, was the fact that everyone who saw McVeigh in Oklahoma City on the morning of the bombing, and there were a lot of people, about 24 people, all saw him with someone else, saw him in some cases with other vehicles. There appeared to be a tremendous amount of confusion in the half hour or so before the bombing. I argue in the book that that's because the original target had to be switched. The original target, I believe, was the federal courthouse next door to the federal building. The plan was to drive the truck into the underground garage that the two buildings shared, and through some ridiculously overlooked fact, the truck was too tall to fit in the garage, and they had to find another place to put it in a big rush. And there are many, many other things like that that it now becomes apparent that investigators were aware of and chose not to pursue.
With the other people in that morning before, of course, as we mentioned, Terry Nichols was always the co-conspirator. And you talk in this book how that list of names should ultimately be expanded. Which brings up two points, and we'll get to the second one in a moment, of who else is on that list. But let us talk about Terry Nichols and why it's solely focused on him and no other.
Well, I think largely because the government had him. And if you talk to people who are involved in the investigation, they don't agree about Terry Nichols, but some people certainly believe that he was as important as McVeigh, if not more important. Others have their doubts. What has emerged, Roger Charles and I had a tremendously long correspondence with Nichols in prison. He answered a lot of our questions in great detail. And that, combined with our other research, paints a picture of Nichols, who really was very much a subordinate. He was almost treated like a gopher by McVeigh. He was under his thumb. He was afraid of McVeigh as time went on. He was afraid of what McVeigh might do to him and his family if he didn't do what he was told. He was a pleaser by nature. He was not, however, that plugged in to the really dangerous radical world that I believe that McVeigh was plugged into. I don't think he was privy to large parts of the plot. And I think he was also used as a potential fall guy. McVeigh used a calling card that that Terry Nichols had obtained under the alias Daryl Bridges. And I think part of the reason why that card was used so that McVeigh could, in a pinch, get Terry Nichols dragged into the plot. And in fact, the reason that the government caught up with Terry Nichols and briefly his brother James before deciding they didn't have enough evidence against him was because of that calling card and because McVeigh gave the Nichols farm address in Michigan as his address. And our research suggests that was no accident. He wanted to have them dragged in, and I believe that the motivation for that was to make sure that while the Nichols brothers got into trouble, no one else that he associated with would. And McVeigh remained silent to the day he was executed about others involved. And Nichols himself, in his correspondence, has not wanted to name more than one other person. And I believe he does have some idea who the other people are, and he's afraid to talk about them again because he's afraid of what might happen to the people he loves on the outside, his family.
One of the things that the two of you read about in the book is that we would perhaps know a more complete list of the co-conspirators if it was not for really lack of judgment and leaks in the media 48 hours in to the investigation.
That's right. I mean, the government knew about the Nichols brothers for the reasons I just mentioned, because of the calling card and because McVeigh had given their address. Ideally, they would have pursued those brothers. They would have tapped their phones. They would have kept them under surveillance and seen where else that might have led. Now, I don't know if it would have led anywhere, but that opportunity was rapidly closed down because news that the feds were after the Nichols brothers was leaked to the media. It was on the radio, and Terry and James both heard it and took evasive action effectively once they realized that the feds were after them. They both left their houses afraid of being caught up in a showdown in which they and their families might be killed. And any possibility that they might have got in touch with other people was immediately closed down.
When it comes to the actual investigation, the rivalries between the agencies, the turf wars, the internal communication, the poor internal communication. These are stories that we hear a lot when it comes to government investigations, and it is first and forefront here. And this is a cultural thing, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think a big part of the reason why Moore was not found out about the possibility of a plot of this nature and possibly this specific plot and the possibility of closing it down was because the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI were not talking to each other on the most important aspects of the threat from the radical far right. The ATF had an informant inside a community in eastern Oklahoma who was reporting back extremely alarming things about people planning to blow up federal buildings, to plot assassinations, mass shootings, to overthrow the government. That community was playing host to members of a neo-Nazi bank robbery gang who were devastatingly effective in knocking over a couple of dozen banks across the Midwest over a two-year period. She had fabulous information. What did the ATF do with that? They decided to close her down and close their eyes and block their ears because they were afraid that if she kept reporting such stellar information, they'd have to take action. And the ATF had been embarrassed and had created chaos both at Ruby Ridge in Idaho in 1992 and at Waco in 1993, and the agency was keenly aware that they were one screw-up away from extinction. The Republican majority in Congress was gunning for them. They were absolutely an agency struggling for survival, and so when it came to the choice between doing their core duty to protect the country and protecting themselves, they chose themselves.
So who is out there responsible for this, in your opinion, who has gone unscathed?
It's a difficult question to answer, first of all, because I'm not an investigator with the kind of powers that the FBI has, and secondly, for legal reasons, it's a little hard to point the finger too strongly at people without having the evidence to back it up, evidence that I believe the FBI and the ATF and the other agencies should have gathered at the time. However, one can look at the radical far-right movement and say, here is a list of people the FBI should have at least questioned. The most dangerous people who either lived or stayed on and off at Elohim City, the community in eastern Oklahoma, should absolutely have been questioned. Most of them never were. Louis Beam, who was the propagandist for the movement, who'd openly declared war on the government, who talked about a strategy of leaderless resistance where people would go off and do their own attacks against the government without talking about it too much so that they couldn't be undone by informants or good police work, he was never questioned about the bombing. I think that was a great oversight. There are a number of people who failed to have alibis that morning who were never questioned. Members of the neo-Nazi bank robbery gang, who I mentioned before, they were actually ratted out by their own fellow robbers, some of whom said person X or person Y was involved in the bombing. You should take a look. The FBI did not. Investigations that should have been coordinated with the bombing investigation, including the one into the bank robbers and others, were not coordinated at all. And so you have a situation where, for example, there was a safe house in Columbus, Ohio that was raided by the FBI. They found blasting caps, they found nitromethane, other things that were used in the Oklahoma City bombing. And the Oklahoma City bombing investigators not only did not have a chance to have a look at that evidence, they were never even told about it.
It's a fascinating story and a very troubling one, obviously. Have we learned from any mistakes?
I think we would have learned more if these mistakes had been articulated sooner. I think a lot of the problems that emerged in the run-up to 9/11 were very similar. You had, you know, very experienced agents shouting from the rooftops that there was a real problem. They were not heard. You had agencies not speaking to each other when they should have been, and on and on. And a generalized failure, I think this is something that law enforcement, not only in this country, but generally tends to be bad at. They're very good at looking at the last threat and making sure that it isn't repeated. They're not as good at anticipating the next threat. I don't think they anticipated the threat from the radical far right in 1995. They didn't anticipate adequately the threat from Al-Qaeda in 2001. And I think something needs to be done to look at how threat assessment is done. Something needs to be done to look at how law enforcement wings speak to each other or don't speak to each other. And, you know, there have certainly been attempts in that direction with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, the establishment of joint terrorism task forces. But all the evidence I'm hearing on the ground from people in federal law enforcement is that nothing fundamentally has changed. It's harder now than it was in 1995 to buy large quantities of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. But other than that, not a lot is out there to stop somebody with determination and an ability to keep a plot reasonably secret from going out and wreaking tremendous havoc, just as McVeigh did in 1995.
Andrew Gumbel is the co-author of Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters, co-written with Roger Charles. It is published by William Morrow. Andrew Gumbel, a great pleasure to have you on the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. It's published by William Morrow. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.